Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adam Mount, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on nuclear security. Previously, he was a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and worked on nuclear elimination contingencies at the RAND Corporation. He is the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by Admiral Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and former Senator Sam Nunn, who have issued a new report, A Sharper Choice on North Korea, Engaging China for a Stable Northeast Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Mount.
Thank you.
And there are, of course, heated rhetoric coming out of North Korea. That's not exactly new, but North Korea's Deputy United Nations Ambassador said today that the U.S. has created a dangerous situation in which a thermonuclear war may break out at any minute. And of course, Vice President Mike Pence is in South Korea warning North Korea not to test again, saying, reiterating that the era of strategic patience is over. So what can be done? To the New York Times did a piece, I think it was yesterday, suggesting that this may be a kind of Cuban Missile Crisis in slow motion. Let's start with that premise. Do you agree with that possibility or that portent?
Well, it's an interesting analogy, isn't it? There are things that are similar about the Cuban Missile Crisis and things that are different. What's similar is the choices that we face, the choices between striking enemy emplacements that could lead to a broader nuclear war, which nobody wants, negotiating a solution, or trying to find ways to contain those deployments and still meet American and allied national security interests. So it's a tough choice, but the choices are similar. What's different about it is that North Korea is much more invested in the deployment of their nuclear and missiles than the Soviets were in their deployment of missiles to Cuba. North Korea sees their nuclear program as safeguarding their own national sovereignty and vital for their national security. And so it's not going to be easy to give them up. Another difference is that the U.S. president now is publicly disdainful of the kind of tough diplomacy that President Kennedy practiced to get the Soviets to withdraw their missiles from Cuba. He's said that the Iran deal was the worst deal that the United States has ever done, which is clearly an exaggeration. And that kind of inflexibility won't serve him well if he's interested in finding ways to limit North Korea's nuclear and missile program. So he's going to have to find ways to talk to the regime if he's interested in changing their military posture.
So just continuing then the Cuba Missile Crisis analogy, would Donald Trump be more closer to General Curtis LeMay than Jack Kennedy?
Well, you would get folks here in Washington agreeing and disagreeing with that analogy. Trump clearly holds he holds an affection for bluster, for expansive rhetoric, something that General LeMay was known for. But thus far, his administration has taken a step back from the possibility of striking North Korea in retaliation for a nuclear or missile test. They've sent contradictory signals about that. One of the dangers is that Trump finds that he has backed himself into a corner with his own rhetoric. So I believe it was during the transition that he posted on Twitter to say that North Korea will not achieve the possibility of placing a nuclear warhead atop an intercontinental ballistic missile that could strike at the continental United States. If he thinks that his credibility depends on that promise, he could find himself backed into a corner where he no longer has options other than war. So when politics gets injected into strategic bargaining, accidents can happen. So that's something that we ought to be aware of.
So the North Koreans, of course, are now, their test fizzled yesterday, but now they're saying that they will test a missile weekly. I talked to an analyst yesterday who suggested that perhaps what they're doing is they're firing off all of their old liquid-fueled missiles now that they've moved to solid-fueled in terms of the medium-range missiles. Is there a possibility that that's what they're doing, that they just know that this antagonizes us, so they keep doing it?
Well, there has been a pattern of North Korea testing missiles periodically. We can never be quite sure why they're testing when. One model is to suggest that they test when they're technologically ready, when they have a when they've developed a new missile system that requires testing to make it work. But on the other hand, sometimes North Koreans clearly test on symbolic occasions. And the test 2 days ago was just like this. It was the North Korean Day of the Sun, which is an enormous holiday in North Korea. And the day after, they chose to test what Western intelligence sources are now telling Fox News was a KN-17. That's a liquid fuel Scud variant, but they wouldn't assign a new designation unless it was a new variant. So I guess the answer to your question is that they test, they're clearly making rapid progress in their missile programs. They're testing more frequently, and they're testing a greater variety of missiles than at any time in the past. And with the new designation of a KN-17, it seems clear that they're continuing to innovate. So while not all of their tests have been successful, it's clear that they are still making progress.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Mount, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on nuclear security. Previously, he was a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and worked on nuclear elimination contingencies at the RAND Corporation. He's the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, and former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, who have issued a new report, A Sharper Choice on North Korea, Engaging China for a Stable Northeast Asia. So let's just briefly go through the points in the report at amount, and just briefly, one, promote a stable and prosperous Northeast Asia, two, restructure negotiations, three, protect human rights, four, enforce sanctions and escalate financial pressure, and five, strengthen deterrence and defense. So let's start with the last one. I spoke the other day with the former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Donald Gregg, who was also Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor, Korea CIA officer. He says that we do have deterrence with North Korea, that they're not suicidal. So let's begin with that.
We absolutely do have a robust deterrent posture towards North Korea. It's something that we focus on every day. U.S. and South Korean our militaries on the peninsula are integrated in what's called a combined forces command. So there are 28,500 American men and women, and their unofficial motto in U.S. Forces Korea is that they're ready to fight tonight. That's no joke. That's no exaggeration. They really are prepared to defend against and to respond to any aggression that the North Koreans can offer. But that doesn't mean that the picture is static. North Korea, as their nuclear and missile programs advance, they're also advancing in other ways. They are fielding more special operations forces, developing submarine capabilities to aggress in the maritime environment. Their cyber aggressions and intrusions into Western banking systems is just one example. There was also a story that reported that they recently hacked U.S. Forces Command in South Korea and perhaps made off with portions of outdated operational plans. The point is that they are capable of aggressing at various levels on this spectrum of conflict. And so it's not just enough to say that we can repulse and resist a conventional invasion. We need to be prepared to defend against and respond to credibly all of these different kinds of aggressive signals. So there are in some ways more that we can do. One example is that more U.S. naval force structure could be really very valuable. More missile defense. You just saw us deploy the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, THAAD, to the peninsula as a way of knocking down North Korean missiles that could be fired towards Seoul. These are the kinds of capabilities that we need to continue to improve to maintain deterrence, because it's not a static target.
But what about deterrence in terms of North Korea? The idea that's often been floated is that Kim Jong-un is crazy and unstable and mercurial, and therefore you don't have the normal stability that mutually assured destruction gives you.
Well, the question of nuclear deterrence is even more complicated. In a case like Russia, the U.S. and Russian arsenals are fairly symmetrical. There are some gradations in where they place their emphasis and where we place ours, but we have a similar number of weapons, and we both concede that we are mutually vulnerable to each other. So we have a mutually assured destruction posture. That's not the case in North Korea. We don't accept mutual vulnerability with North Korea. We don't accept them as a nuclear state. So figuring out how to do deterrence under these circumstances and to maintain stability, right, to deter aggression at lower levels of escalation, like in the cyber domain, like with special operations forces, is a complex challenge. It's not as simple as saying that we have nuclear weapons, so therefore North Korea will sit on their hands. They've continually proven motivated in trying to find cracks and gaps in allied defenses to try to score points where they can. So, like I say, it's a moving target, and it's not a simple answer.
So is that then to say that the massive nuclear arsenal and the massive capabilities of the U.S. and the South Koreans still doesn't deter North Korea from possibly, we know that they've shelled islands and they've sunk ships and they've sent hit teams in, one of which killed the former, the outgoing head of South Korea's mother, trying to target, of course, the president of South Korea at the time. So how do you explain that? That on the one hand, Donald Gregg says they're not suicidal. On the other hand, they do some pretty provocative things.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think what we're getting at is saying that deterrence is not a unitary entity. You can't just establish deterrence and expect a country to be deterred from any kind of aggressive activity at all. Deterrence is variegated. You need to find ways of deterring specific actions. So, for example, we have manifestly failed at deterring North Korea from testing their nuclear arsenal or developing their missile programs. That's another thing that this administration is going to have to learn. After North Korea did not test a nuclear weapon this weekend, the administration made signs, for example, that suggested that the military moves that they have made towards the peninsula prevented them from doing that, deterred them from doing that. Now, when North Korea inevitably does test a missile and most likely tests another nuclear weapon, they can't be surprised by that because deterrence is not unitary. So we need to find ways of deterring other kinds of actions day in, day out. It's a constant challenge.
Well, at this point, China, I mean, the president said he had a really good conversation with President Xi of China recently down in Mar-a-Lago at his retreat in Florida. Some people are suggesting that actually Xi educated Trump about some of the basics about the Chinese relationship with North Korea, that one, the Chinese don't like the regime and they never have, and two, the North Koreans don't like the Chinese. And since then, we know that the coal ships have been turned back and airline travel has been curtailed. So what will the effect be of putting the squeeze on if indeed China sticks with this policy? Are they going to relent, or at least they may not give in to U.S. demands, but will they give in to Chinese demands if indeed the Chinese are making demands? I guess we don't know.
So there are two questions here. The first question is whether the United States can encourage China to place more pressure on North Korea. The second question is, if they did, what difference would it make? So with respect to the first, as you've noted, China is sending mixed signals. They're clearly not where they were 5 or 10 years ago. They're clearly more interested in placing pressure on North Korea. And I believe that there are members within the regime or within the Chinese leadership that are increasingly coming to see North Korea as a threat to regional stability rather than as a guarantor of regional stability, as a buffer against American power. And so they are sending more signals. They are signing on to increasingly assertive UN Security Council resolutions that restrict North Korean trading rights, for example. But on the other hand, they just released the other day numbers that showed that their trade with North Korea is increasing. So it's not one way or the other. But there is an opportunity here to convince China that the U.S. and Chinese interests, in fact, overlap on North Korea, that we're both interested in restraining their nuclear and missile programs and aggressive behavior. Now, even if China did lean on North Korea, as hard as that question is, it's even more difficult to imagine what difference it would make. North Korea, as their nuclear and missile programs have advanced, the price has gone up. And it may not be possible now to expect negotiations to start from the premise of an elimination of their nuclear weapons arsenal. So we're going to have to, if we do get back into negotiations, find ways to work up to that. So you might start from an agreement that has to do with stability or arms control on the peninsula, and then work your way up to denuclearization talks. That's the kind of flexibility that Donald Trump has not exhibited so far in international diplomacy, but it's what would be necessary.
Well, just in closing, Adam Mount, what about the possibility, though, you know, they always talk about thinking outside of the box, but it would seem to me that if the U.S. and the South Koreans were to basically just completely forget about a military solution, and they have these ridiculous talks at Panmunjom where they go through this ritual. They have been doing that since 1953. But what say the U.S. actually put a peace treaty on the table and said, look, let's just get, you know, the war's not ended. Let's get a peace treaty. We'll recognize you and we don't want to bother you and we withdraw our troops and let's just sign a peace treaty. Wouldn't that completely undercut the Kim regime? Because doesn't it, the glue that holds that regime together is this paranoia, which they constantly pump out.
Right.
From the day that kids are born to, you know, cradle to grave, they're told the Americans are coming, the Americans are coming. What say the Americans refuse to be the enemy anymore? What would happen?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. The best hope that we have for moderating North Korea's behavior is to do exactly that, is to find ways of moderating the regime's behavior in exchange for concessions. In some of these cases, they are military concessions. Now, U.S. forces on the peninsula are not going to leave until the threat from North Korea ameliorates or decreases. But at the same time, we could talk about moderating U.S.-South Korean exercises, and then we could look forward to a future in which the United States does not need forces on the peninsula because North Korea is denuclearized. It's not clear, as you suggest, that North Korea is interested in a deal like that because it's the paranoia that maintains internal control. But I think it's a conversation that's worth having and it's worth working toward. But there, you know, as you said, there are no good options here.
Well, Adam Mount, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Mount, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on nuclear security. Previously, he was a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and worked on nuclear elimination contingencies at the RAND Corporation. He is the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, and former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, who have issued a new report, A Sharper Choice on North Korea, Engaging China for a Stable Northeast Asia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.